Concession number 17747, Real 39.
What were your relations with the civil population like on the approaches to the Gothic Line?
They were good. Of course, it was not a thickly populated area. These were hill villages. But we were welcomed. They had not seen any Western troops at all. They'd seen the Germans, of course, come and go. But I noted in my diary that we were feted with eggs and wine and made generally welcome. And I think we began to have our first consciousness of the partisan movement at this time. And I'm speaking now not from diaries but from memory, that you became aware that there was an active anti-German movement. This was perhaps a feeling coming through casual conversations rather than firm knowledge of having seen them, which we did do later, of course. It was a curious no man's land. I don't mean in the literal military sense, but because we were moving through an area fairly rapidly, following our Indian 5th Indian Brigade, and we were out of touch with our own guns. I don't mean out of contact, but out of range. There was nothing they could do, and therefore there was nothing we could do to direct their fire. Anyway, we were not in touch with the enemy. This was approaching the defensive lines, which the Germans were constructing, or had been constructing for some time, as we later found, because they were very well dug in indeed. They had a year or whatever to do this, and they're very thorough, as in most things. I remember mentioning last time we met that we had lovely views from 300 foot high hills, and spending the night in a plantation of tomatoes, a model horticultural effort which had been done by, no doubt, under the Mussolini planning. That's right. We move off on 28th of August after the Sikhs, who are now going at great speed, and the Gurkhas too. Since we can't reach anything with our guns, we are, as attack party, we are recalled to RHQ proper, and waited by a river for a couple of hours, and just readjusted ourselves to life in proper RHQ, which of course means dealing with paperwork and some sort of approach to proper messing, bringing the regimental diary up to date, war diary, writing letters and so on. As a junior officer, life was always easier if the seniors were not present, and I've noted that the CO and the second in command were a nuisance, but thank goodness they're out on reconnaissance much of the time. I had a letter from my brother, who was well into the second front by now.
He was ashore in Normandy by that stage.
He was ashore in Normandy. He had been since D-Day, in fact. He went ashore with a signals brick, as I think they called it, on the 6th of June. He was talking, I don't know why, about a proposed early marriage, but nothing came of that. That I do know. I've noted, we had a clear idea what was going on, that the Germans were pulling back to their main defensive line, and we knew that this easy progress we were making would not continue. It was an illusion to think that the Germans were retreating. They were not. They were pulling back.
Making a staged withdrawal.
Staged withdrawal, that's admirable, yes.
You mentioned partisans. Did you actually encounter any as such, or did you just hear of them?
We encountered them, but later than this. We, you know, had our episodes later on with village squares, with the women who had fraternized having their hair cut off in public, which was rather distressing, and one had to stop troops from intervening in this, which would have been catastrophic.
Were you aware of any representatives of the Allied military government of occupied territories?
Only, we knew they were there, of course, and they were the AMGOT was known to be there behind the scenes and coming forward with its imposed civil rule until for the transitional period until the Italians could take over. But which I was far too junior and out of touch to know the detail of. We, of course, saw the Allied military government banknotes taking over. I still have some of those, 400 lira to the pound.
Did you have any specific orders about not interfering with the partisans?
I don't remember, because their activities were not so well codified as to have become the subject of army instructions. It was the received wisdom that this was their war, a separate war from that we were conducting. They were conducting the kind of disciplinary activity on a lower level that we see being conducted regrettably in Northern Ireland. But it was not part of the business of fighting the war that we were in, and it just was not our business. I don't mean that we would have stood by and watched people being hanged, but a hair cut off is slightly different from that, and is obviously local vengeance, not to be confused with major tactics or whatever. And this was the mores of the people concerned. And
how did you dissuade the soldiers from intervening?
Oh, I don't think it took much, in fact. I mean, you just say, look, this isn't our business. Lay off. Don't be chivalrous. After all, these people, these women, probably, they may very well have hazarded your own lives by fraternising, etc., etc.
But they did feel a sort of desire to put a stop to humiliation.
I think it's the usual civilised wish that even minor barbarities shouldn't go unremarked. And I don't think it bit very hard, but there were people who are inclined to go in and take over judicial processes. The Italian populations, on the whole, were not. I mean, there were not many voices being raised on behalf of these women. This didn't happen very often. I saw it perhaps three or four times. That's all I'm speaking of. It was not going on a mass sort of barber scale. On the 30th of August, a sort of false dawn, air photos made it look as though our infantry may now be through the Gothic line. Ha ha ha. We think the Germans may have been surprised by the speed. I'm quite busy sorting out air photos, reconnaissance photos. Lovely country, but no walking is allowed or sensible because of mines. Shoe mines in particular, which were tending to blow people's feet off. Small plastic Italian mines were another variety. They were scattered. You could see them in the fields, red and other colours.
Were these unmarked minefields?
Oh, they were not minefields at all. I mean, we just knew there were mines about everywhere. They were not... I mean, there were places where there were actual minen for minefields, but these were just meadows. And this is why it wasn't safe to go anywhere. You couldn't take a carefree walk through an orchard. And I remember wryly noticing how the Italians who had to continue for their livelihood, their farming, they tended to... I mean, perhaps this is unduly cynical. In fact, I'm sure it is racist. But it seemed to be the women who went ahead and the men who followed behind. Well, it was first the woman and then the donkey and then the man. But perhaps this was a prejudice we acquired at the time.
Did you suffer any casualties as a result of this? These mines and booby traps?
Yes, I noted that. Where did I see this? Somebody went out and had his foot blown off by a shoe mine. And that sort of thing spreads caution very rapidly.
Had you had any training in mine clearance?
No, none whatever.
What were you supposed to do if you suspected that a route you had to traverse was...
Oh, to mark it and steer people round it and report it to the Royal Engineers.
Did they generally have a short response time?
Well, we had gone by the time they arrived, so we didn't know. I mean, we didn't stand around waiting for them. We would mark it off and report it.
And then move on.
And then move on. I mean, it mustn't be allowed to hold us up.
I was going to ask if there are occasions where, as a result of you being on somewhat narrow approaches, you were held up, because you were saying that when the Sikhs and Gurkhas were making their initial attacks on the outposts, you couldn't get the guns up within range in time to give support.
Yes, that of course has nothing to do with mines or anything like that. Yes, this was just general progress. On narrow approaches, it's perfectly true that, mines could be a problem. Indeed, we had noted way back in the days at Salerno that booby-trapped bodies on roads did bring whole columns to a halt until somebody did something about them. Not necessarily defusing or blowing up the mines, but trying to find alternative routes as long as they were not too far around. But the German delaying tactics did involve, of course, using mines, as one would expect.
Because here you're in mountains, aren't you,
yes.
In the Gothic line?
Yes.
And in mountains, especially with larger pieces of equipment, like guns,
yes.
The routes are...
Constricted. Constrained. That's perfectly true. I have no detailed recollection of how we got round this, but I don't think that... It wasn't a situation in which our guns were being held up because of obstruction. It was simply the normal speed constraints of moving a regiment of guns. I mean, they're quite heavy, lumbering things, and we were able to go ahead much more quickly in scout cars and tactical vehicles than the guns and their limbers and the like, which could take an awful long time to go up narrow defiles.
The other thing that engineers can do, of course, is demolitions.
Yes.
Did you encounter any of those?
You mean demolition of outcrops of rock to widen roads, kind of thing?
Artificial landslides.
I mean, the engineers did wonderful jobs of building up roads. I mean, one is talking partly about the kind of road that winds up round the hill and
these
narrow
bends.
Hairpin bends, the usual thing you encounter if you go on holiday in the Alps or something of this kind, but on a much more primitive scale, because it was 50 years ago, and because these were little used roads. They were never built to take guns. And so the reinforcement of the roads, particularly on these hairpin bends, was quite a feature. I can't remember how the engineers did it, or the engineers and the pioneers presumably together, but it was done, and the things did get through. And I think the logistics of the whole operation really hinged round making the approach roads adequate for the guns. Otherwise we'd have never got through.
Were these roads for the most part properly surfaced? Were they tarmacked, or were they paved, or hardened in some other way?
It's enormously variable. I mean, approaching the towns or major villages, you would find the roads quite well made up. Other times, they would be in the more remote areas, they would not be made up. But we were constantly impressed by the quality of road making compared with that which most of us knew at home in rural areas. The Italians were very good road makers. It seemed to have come down in an unbroken line right from the Romans. And an awful lot of expertise and work had gone into roads. What they couldn't cope with any more than anybody could have, of course, was the onset of heavy rain and mud, which would wash away and would make traversing any surface very difficult. But on the whole, I think the Italian roads and, in some cases, their stone bridges did impress us as amateurs. I noted on the 1st of September, you're talking about mines, a man just outside the RHQ loses his foot on a shoe mine. And by this time, we had arrived, I don't know what the position, location was, but the regiment fires its first shots in anger since March. So it was March to September, the interval between actually beginning to kill people again. And we heard, of course, at second hand through the radio that British armour was doing great work in northern France. But we were concerned made to think hard by the intelligence knowledge that despite the British armour advance in northern France, the Germans have nonetheless chosen to bring in fresh divisions to face us here. So obviously they meant business. Second of September, I see off to TAC HQ with the 167 Brigade, our old original allies, the Fusiliers and the Queens.
So you were taken away from supporting the Indian Division?
Yes, I don't know when, but it had happened by this time, the regrouping.
56th Division had presumably passed through the lines of the the Indian Division. Would that be 4th Indian Division?
Yes, it was. Yes, that's right. Well, it could be, or it could be. I don't know what reasons of deployment may have applied, but I mean, it wasn't. I think it's probably something different from passing through, because we had actively been supporting the 5th Indian Brigade. We were not simply going through them, we were with them.
Yes.
And now we were back with 167 Brigade, all within the space of a couple of weeks. And we heard that 169 Brigade, which was one of the other brigades in the division, was already fighting quite fiercely. We called off our own tactical separate location and simply went in to the 167 main 167 Brigade main headquarters, which is in a large house and was fairly comfortable. And we heard our first shells landing nearby at this time.
This is a co-location of the battery of the artillery regimental headquarters with the...
Not the regimental headquarters, with our TAC headquarters.
Your TAC headquarters, so it's your forward element.
We set up our TAC within the main 167. Normally, there would have been a tactical headquarters with the brigadier from the brigade and our colonel at a separate forward small location.
A sort of command post rather than the headquarters.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
But whereas at this point, we actually went in to the main headquarters, the brigadier, their brigadier, our colonel, the lot, we were all together without establishing a separate minor forward location. There must have been reasons of the ground for doing this.
Could it have been that attacking a fortified position like the Gothic Line is really very much a set-piece operation that has to be planned in advance and cannot be improvised as you're going along?
I think that's right. I think I'm sure you're right about that. And I think that we were now, down to the hard business, and people had not been sure until now what the hard business was going to be like. And now it was becoming clear that you had got as far as you were going to get easily, and so the senior people needed to do some pretty hard thinking and settle down to do it rather than swanning off into tactical positions, there had to be, I would think, the planning of major battles, not just a slow progress of the kind we had been having for so much of our time in Italy. This was no longer attrition of a mobile kind, but you needed to reappraise what you were up to when you realised how strong the Gothic line was likely to be. Yes, you see, I went up. We must have been quite close to the Germans, because I noted that a day or so later I went out in a scout car right up to the front, just by being right up to the front, half a mile from the enemy, which is only distance from here to the station, just seeing what was happening. Brigadier, who was now Brigadier Scott Elliott, Brigadier Firth, having left 167 Brigade some time ago, Brigadier Scott Elliott and my CO, Colonel Zambra, seemed to me as a junior to be in a bit of a flap. They were not quite confident of what was happening or what they should be doing. And we set up attack headquarters, the Brigadier and the CO and I, in a house after inspecting it carefully for booby traps.
This was forward of the main headquarters. This was forward. I'd been describing
us being in the main headquarters, and then we moved out and did establish a tactical HQ. The attack goes in by 167 Brigade. It's the first attack by 167 Brigade since the Anzio Bridgehead.
So that's quite a considerable period, isn't it, between the Anzio Bridgehead attacks and the attack here?
On reflection, there would be quite a lot of new troops involved, individual soldiers and officers, because they had lost a great many people at Anzio. So for some people, they would be the old sweats going in again. For others, quite a lot of them, it would be their first time in action, I would guess. We are being mortared now, so we're fairly close to the enemy. We felt pretty safe in the building.
So this is your TAC HQ being mortared?
That's right.
Was this concentrated mortaring, or...?
I can't remember, but I think it was probably fairly desultory. It's the sort of thing in which you are aware of something... Well, you hear very vividly something landing in the orchard at the side of the house, and then you hear the next one would take tiles off and a chimney, perhaps, but you don't sense that you are being accurately targeted. It is too loose, the grouping of the mortar shells, mortar bombs landing, to feel that they have got you pinned down.
What sort of house was it that you were in?
It would be the typical large, well-made Italian farmhouse of the kind one sees on picture postcards.
Were you in any particular room in the house? Were you in the cellar, or were
We're not in the cellars. We're in the main rooms with the protection, illusory though it might have been, of one or two floors above us.
Fairly solid walls.
Fairly solid, yes, but never as solid as they looked. It was always a shock to see, for example, churches when we had shelled them, revealing these beautiful stone columns as being hollow shams. There was simply a facing of stone with rubble inside, and so one wouldn't necessarily take for granted that what appeared to be a solid stone farmhouse was in quite as solid as it looked. But reasonable building, yes.
Do you remember anything about the brigade's plan of attack for this first serious attempt on the
No, I don't. What I made a rough note of was that obviously we got their sleep on Monday, Tuesday or Wednesday, the 4th, 5th, 6th of September, and Thursday we were still in heavy action. There were constant calls from the infantry for supporting fire. The 8th and 9th Fusiliers reached their objectives with casualties not very heavy, which was a relief. And that was that for the time being. I jotted down the name of the hill feature, which was the objective. I can't see what. Oh yes, the Montefiore feature. Mm. Montefiore being a fairly common name in Italian, yes. It doesn't tell us very much. That's where the attack began on Sunday the 3rd, and I had noted wryly that these things always seem to happen on Sundays. But by Thursday, we were still. We had reached this point I've noted, that the 8th and 9th Fusiliers had reached their objectives. But suddenly, quite suddenly, and not having known what the next move was likely to be, the whole brigade, including our guns, was called forward, and we start a night march into enemy lines. Well, it can't have been quite literally true, but it must have been fairly true. I'm in the second vehicle from the front of this march, and we're all very, very tired, and we have to stop at a blown bridge. And then the scout car, the wretched thing, gets bogged down, and we recover it frantically before first light would expose it to the enemy observation posts.
Could this be an attempt to actually get through perceived gaps in the Gothic line simply by moving at night to get into the rear of the...
Well, I mean, the reason for moving at night was the obvious defensive one, that you knew that the roads were very limited in their capacity and that you would be a sitting duck if you moved in daylight. That's the reason for moving at night. But why the reason for moving at all with this urgency, I don't know, except that once again there may have been the illusion or indeed the reality that the Germans were pulling back to another stage of their defensive line, and one didn't want them to get too happily settled in.
Well, around about this time, there had been an operation in Normandy called Totalize, in which two divisions plus had advanced southwards and had just gone through the German lines by moving at night.
Mm.
And this meant that the Germans were not able to enjoy the superiority given them by their 88s.
Mm.
And by the time daylight came again in the morning, they found that their forward positions had been compromised because our armour and some infantry were behind them, and they abandoned their forward positions and went back.
Yes. I don't know about the detail of that, but it would... I would hazard a guess that we're talking about different situations in terms of concentration of territory and of troops. We're talking here about Italy being, 80 miles across with two armies, the 5th and the 8th, fully deployed. We're talking about limited number of inadequate roads and the prospects of getting through in the way you describe there, although... in theory open to us, I don't think in practice would have been, because it just wasn't the room to get through.
So you're just moving forward then to another segment of the line,
Yes, that's right, yes. But trying to do it rapidly enough to not to give the Germans the comfort of another few days to dig themselves in or whatever. Yes. Move forward, in other words, keep pushing them.
Was this move opposed in any way? Did you come under mortar or artillery fire or any other opposition?
Not during that night march, we certainly didn't. We moved, I don't know how far, but one would have guessed that it could have been anything from 10, 15 miles, quite a long way for a night march, including a whole brigade and a whole regiment of 24, 25-pound guns. These things are always confused, of course. All you know more about your own unit's movement than about other people's, because the process of being on the march moving forward means that you're no longer in a situation where you can go and look at maps and see from the latest